Good morning. I've already learned so much. Charity muggers, that was good. Learned some dance moves from Pete. The fire was my favorite one. So that's exciting. But I am really, really honored to be with you. Just before we do anything else, I just want to take a second to commend your leaders to you, Pete and B. You're inside of this church, so you might just have an expectation that, like, pastors and leaders are all sort of the same, and they're not. I get to travel all over and be a part of a lot of different churches around the country, around the world, and it's important for you to know that you have some of just exceptional people that love Jesus and love this church and love your city. And you might not realize what a gift they are to you. And you also might not realize that your church is really, really important in what God is doing all over the world. You know, it's just your church. But that's right. Take your time. Do you need to get it or no? Sure. Okay. You might. I'm really endearing myself to you, aren't I? Anyway, you might not realize that, you know, all over the world there's churches that are in major cities that God is doing incredible things in, and your church is one of those churches that people look at from literally all over the world. Looking to learn from, to just pick up the models and the risks that you're taking, just to hear the stories here this morning are just incredibly encouraging and sadly are often rare across the world in some of the largest cities that we have. So I just want to commend your leaders to you and your church. And so ultimately what that means for you as a part of this church is there's a lot of pressure on you, so don't screw it up. You thought that was a joke. Anyway, really don't. Just don't screw it up. Well, we have a number of times together, I am really, really honored to be with you. And a little bit about me and about our church. I'm from Denver, Colorado, the Mile High City. Hence the Mile High Vineyard. No airplanes necessary. I mean, I know when you live at sea level, it's hard to imagine cities a mile high, but we have one of those. And so we've lived there. We moved from Columbus, Ohio, which is in the Midwest, to Colorado the September 11th, 2001. We actually loaded our truck, and I saw the towers falling from the truck place where I rented to move. Moved with 12 people, and I'm a vineyard pastor, and the vineyard spends lots of money on their church plants. We were sent with $3,000, which is more than it used to be here. So that's good news. And we moved. And I got a job waiting tables. We threw parties, just got to know people, met in a house. And over time, God has just grown a church. So as of this last baptism for our church, we've baptized just over 1,100 people in the life of our church. And so, you know, from the beginning, our heart was always for those who were just far from Christ, who had never heard about Jesus, never had an opportunity to have life with Jesus. Not just sort of choosing the church that they like, that has the best, you know, laser show or whatever. But people that had never maybe even heard about Jesus. And most of that was formed because of just my own story. I wasn't raised in church. I have no church background. And so when I was about 16, had an encounter with God in my room one night that effectively screwed up the rest of my life and has led me to be here. But it's also formed just my convictions about what we do and what we're up to, what it means to live and love and follow Jesus. And my good friend Rob Morgan is with me. He's here. He's my armor bearer. That's what he keeps calling himself, which I don't even know what that means. But he says he's my armor bearer. We both have two girls that are 13 and 10. So yes, I am that old. And so you can help me. I have a teenager as of a month ago, which is. It's a learning experience, is what I'll say. And my wife, Danielle, sends her greetings as well. But this morning, I just want to, just for this little brief time, talk a little bit about God's heart for those that are furthest away. It would be my basic assumption, this is really all we'll talk about this morning, it's my basic assumption that if we want to follow Jesus and do the ministry of Jesus, we should receive the same critiques that Jesus received. That the same resistance that Jesus encountered when he did what he did, we should expect to receive. Now, for people that have not read the scriptures, the New Testament, the Gospels, they're often surprised to hear the kind of resistance that Jesus experienced. When I'm with people that have never been raised in church or they've never been around, you know, this thing that we're doing here, and I say, what do you think was the hardest thing for Jesus? Like, who was it that was coming at him the most, and who was he in sharp arguments with? Who does he, like, fight with? And nearly everyone that has been raised in church says, I don't know, he's probably arguing with, like, sinful people that he's trying to get them to, like, behave better. He's trying to talk them into being more religious or doing better things. And, of course, if you've read the New Testament, you know that that couldn't be further from the truth. The people that Jesus is in constant, sharp argument with are the most religious people. The people that take their life with God the most seriously, that have gone through massive sacrifice in their life. They've given up money and time and energy to follow God are the ones that are the most confused and resistant to the ministry of Jesus. I only say this to say that I don't think things have changed that much. If you truly want to love and follow Jesus, you can expect that the sharpest critique, the most difficult conversations you'll have, will be with the most religious around you. People that have done all the work to describe what they think it is to have life with God and are more than happy to tell you, that what you're doing is not okay. Make no mistake about it, the thing that got Jesus killed, the thing that got him in the most trouble, was the fact that he hung out with the wrong people. That he spent time in people's homes that he wasn't supposed to be with. And so what that means is, if we're going to follow Jesus, from time to time we should be accused of hanging out with sketchy people. From time to time, we should be breaking some of the boxes of, like, the expectations of the religious communities around us. And page after page of the New Testament, we find the religious elite fighting with Jesus about how he's not hanging out with the right people, how he's making the wrong kinds of friends. And mostly, he kind of just lets it happen. He just, like, they attack him, they mess him. He's too busy doing what he's doing to sort of address it. He's like, nah, whatever. You know, church people are weird, you know, which they are. You know, whatever. I'm just going to leave him alone. But there's one section in the New Testament, in the Gospels, that Jesus sort of gets laser focused. And he tells three stories in a row. It's actually the passage you were referring to, where he tells three stories in a row to defend and clarify what he thinks his ministry is about. See, this is really important for us to look at these passages, because here's the truth. As we begin to follow Jesus, if we aren't careful, we begin to tilt everything that we understand about God towards ourselves. How do I make my life better? How do I take care of my needs? How do I make sense of like the problems I'm experiencing? Why am I still single? Why don't I get what I want? And we begin to address life with God as though, you know, what God's supremely interested in is just like making your life just like a little bit better than it was last week or last year. And we're really confused when it doesn't, you know, why isn't God as interested in me as I am? And so much of what happens in communities of faith is we become increasingly more self-focused, and we have to be continually reminded of God's heart for those that are furthest away. That the scriptures are radically unbalanced and tilted towards those that are furthest away. And so when Jesus has this opportunity, he zeroes in and he tells these three stories. I very, very briefly want to look at them with you. And I have incredible amounts of confidence and faith that just even in this little time this morning, God might remind us again of people that, well, that surround us every single day that are furthest away. So if you have a Bible or a device of some kind that has the scriptures, you can flip to Luke 15. Luke chapter 15, this is scripture that is very, very familiar to many of us who have been around church. And so I'm going to ask you to do something. I'm asking you to read these stories as though you've not heard them before. I know that's difficult to do. In other words, don't skip ahead in the story. Don't like look at what's about to happen. Just try as much as you can to stay where we are as we're talking about this together. Is that fair? Can you try that? Four of you can't. Good. Okay, so Luke chapter 15 opens this way. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, the most religious people, muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Again, that is the context of these stories. Jesus is not speaking to the crowds. He's speaking to the religious among us. The people that have dedicated time, money, and energy to just focus their life on God. The kind of people that would pay money to go away on a retreat. Anyway, okay, here it is. Here it is. Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. He calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. First story speaks to a large swath of the audience, which would be farmers, people that work with sheep, like work with animals. And he tells a story they'd be really familiar with. You know, if you have 100 sheep, one of them runs away, you don't just go, "Eh, that's one, whatever." You chase it, and you go get it, and you bring it back. And you could imagine the crowd of people, different people that tend to sheep, kind of all nodding, like, "Well, yeah, of course." He says, this is what God is like. God isn't just focused on the ones he has. He's focused on the ones that are furthest away. And so he's describing his own ministry. Now, it's important to understand how poignant this little story is, and even just the analogy of sheep in general. I don't know how many of you have spent time around sheep. Have you spent time around sheep? A few of you have. You would know this if you have done this. Sheep are exceptionally stupid. I mean, exceptionally stupid. We were just out at a farm in Devon, and we heard this story this week. So this literally just happened. A guy who tends to all these different sheep that we become friends with, he says that this sheep, he says sheep really have two goals: to escape and kill themselves. And they don't know they're doing it. This sheep had gone to eat at some kind of contraption and just kept pushing it until it crushed them. The sheep crushed itself, and the other sheep just climbed on his dead body to get the food. So when Jesus says, you know, you're like sheep, this is not a compliment. He's effectively saying, you're really dumb. And you run away for no reason, and then you just sort of follow the others no matter, you know, what they're doing. And when a shepherd would have a sheep run away, one of these sheep, I don't know if you've ever seen, you've ever seen the picture of Jesus, you know, with the lamb around his shoulder, you know that one? The lamb around his shoulders, and he's like Aryan Jesus. It's like coiffed golden hair, bright blue eyes staring wistfully with the, you know, the lamb around his shoulder. You know, there's like literally 0% of that is real in any way. Like, number one, he's not white. Looks more like me than like most of you. So anyway, it's not white. And the sheep, like the way that farmers go and get that sheep that runs away, is if they catch that sheep, well, first, the way they catch them is they have that, you know, that big staff with the hook. You know what that's for, right? To grab them by the neck, drag them over. And then what a shepherd would do for specifically a sheep that's prone to run away is they take one of its legs and break it in their hands, snap, and then carry it. That's why he's carrying it. He broke one of his legs. And the reason they do that is so that the sheep remembers the scent of the shepherd and is drawn close to the shepherd again to remember its connection with the shepherd. So, you know, next time you see that picture, just right before it, imagine Jesus going, gah! And boy, is this not true? I mean, isn't it just true that the way that most people draw close to God is in the context of crisis? Like, you remember, wait a minute, there is a God and I am not him. And I need to be restored. But that shepherd chases after you, that for most of us, in retrospect, we can say, man, a series of crises were some of the best things that ever happened in my life to draw me back into life with God. There's some of you here, you're going, I am going through a really hard time, and I just want to say, it's very possible that some of you years from now will say, thank God that I lost that job. Thank God that I didn't marry that loser. Seemed like, you know, or they wouldn't go out with me. That one person I just was like, well, you know, it seemed like the greatest loss, the greatest disappointment. But somewhere in there I was drawn closer to God. I remembered what it is to have life with him. So that's the first story. The second story, which is really powerful and it has a similar theme, is commonly called the parable of the lost coin. It says this: or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together, says, rejoice with me, I found my lost coin. In the same way, I tell you, there's rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. He turns from the male farmers and he focuses on women. He speaks directly to women. Now, again, the cultural context for this story is everything to understand why this is so powerful. In the time of Jesus, single women who were available would wear a necklace of 10 coins. The 10 coins signified they came from a family of means and that they were available. It was as though they were saying, you could have this and the coins. Right? It was just like a it was just like a display that you come from a kind of family that, you know, is worth pursuing and that you're available. Now, single ladies. All the single ladies. Listen here. Put your hands up. Listen, because this is addressed to you. Listen to this. Imagine if that's the context you're in, okay? That's the way you are displaying to the weekend away. I am available. Just imagine. And one of the coins goes missing. One of the coins of the 10 goes missing. Like, there's no way you're going to walk out. What if Mr. Wright is right there? What if he is around the corner? He's outside my room in the hallway. This is going to be my first moment to meet him. And I got nine coins. I'm not looking right. I mean, you listen. I mean, come on. I mean, there's a lot of single ladies in the house this morning. I assume. I mean, listen. I'm just going to coach you up a little bit right now. Here you go. You got to come into the, you got to come into a room like this looking right. I mean, like. Wait, let me just coach you. This. You want to find somebody, this is the right kind of room, right? So, like, you don't want to come in here looking messed up. You come in here looking right. Am I preaching right now? Who am I? Gentlemen, am I speaking the truth? I mean, okay, so like, can you? I know it's a little awkward. Hang in there. We're gonna get through it. But you starting to feel that tension? That. Can you imagine? You lost one of those coins. You call your friends. Get in this room and find this freaking coin. Like, wait, I am not leaving this room until I get it. And they find, ha-ha, we found the coin. Now we can leave. Jesus is describing a scenario where nothing happens until this coin is found. Everything stops until this coin is found. I'm married, and when I asked my wife to marry me, Danielle, I had worked a year straight, extra shifts, to buy a ring. Didn't have a lot of money. I mean, just always picking up an extra thing here and there to get a little money. I buy a ring. I ask her to. And I still don't know quite why, but she said yes. And then we were approaching our wedding day. 2 weeks before our wedding, my wife, my girlfriend then, calls me and says, Jay, I have really bad news. I'm listening. I lost the ring. So I started doing the math. I can't get another ring. So, we were dating, which means I was still consistently lying to her. So I, that's what dating is mostly. So Right, you just put your best foot forward, you clean your car, you clean all the time, you do all, you know, then you get married and people find out who you really are. But anyway, so I was still consistently lying. So I stayed really calm. I went, you know what? Totally fine. You know, we're going to figure this out. It's not that big a deal. Are you at home right now? Yeah, I'm home. You know, I think maybe I'll just come over. Help you look. Great. So, you know, we're looking at all the drawers, all the countertops. Look in the car. It wasn't long before I was taking, you know, the plumbing apart. Looking in the sink drain. It degraded to the point that I was crawling on my hands and knees along the edge of the wall, feeling into the crack as though somehow it just, I don't know, it just got kicked into, I don't even know what I was thinking, but you just, you know, you just, your brain breaks and you just start frantically searching. That's what Jesus is describing. When we say that people are lost, most of the time people think that we're thinking about lost versus found, as though the found are somehow better and the lost are just lost. When Jesus describes being lost, he describes value. He's describing value. That until this is found, everything stops. Value. In America, we call it high school. I think here, secondary school. We get a diploma, you know, like a piece of paper that says you made it through. You get one of those? Yeah. Get this piece of paper. It says, good job. You made it. Just right now, just curious, how many of you know where that piece of paper is? How many of you know? Okay. Just so you know, people raise their hand, we don't like you. It means you're just too organized. I have no idea where that is. I don't know. Like, who cares, right? But here's the thing. I know I have it. It's like in a box somewhere in my garage or up in the attic. I know I have it. I just don't care where it is. So technically, it's not law. I just don't care. That's not what he's talking about. He's not saying it's misplaced. Yeah, they're out there somewhere. He's saying, no, they're valuable. And Jesus is saying, why can't you see what I see? Why don't you realize the value of these people who are so far away? He says it in the most offensive way possible. He says it in terms of value. He says they're more valuable than the other 99. They're more valuable. Everything stops until they come home. This is radically offensive. And listen, I know we all came here from different places, different environments. I can't help but wonder if even in this room right now, there's some of you that you know, maybe nobody's aware, but you know that you're really far from God. Maybe you've never even said, I'm going to give the whole of my life to Jesus. And you're amongst all these people going, what is this? What, I got tricked into being here. I don't even know what this is. I thought we'd play some golf, and I'm doing Christian karaoke. Like, what happened? Okay, like, I know in a room this size, there's decent odds there's someone here that doesn't know what it is to have life with Jesus. Listen to me. It's very important. I might only be speaking to one person. Listen to me. The eyes of God are fixed on you. He sees you with such value. In a way that, and this might offend many of you here, in a way that his eyes are not fixed on the rest of us. That's what Jesus says. That if you're here and you don't know where you're at with Jesus, you don't know what it is to have life with God, or you're not sure, or you're just resisting that, he's fixed on you. And he's chasing after you. The last story is the one that's the most popular, the one that we're the most aware of. It's commonly called the prodigal son or the lost son. I won't do it in great detail. It's a pretty simple story. It basically goes something like this. Two sons, of course, in a Middle Eastern family. The oldest son is supposed to get the inheritance. First, the younger son comes to the father, who's God in the story, and says, I don't want to wait for you to die. Can I just have my money? I mean, that's really what he says. It's effectively a way of saying, I wish you were dead. I have two girls, 13 and 10. I try to imagine how this would go. If my youngest came to me and said, hey, Dad, don't really want to wait for you to die. Can I have my money now? I think I might say something like, you're going to wish you were dead in a minute. But let me tell you what I know I wouldn't do. I wouldn't give the money. I mean, of all the things I would do, I would not give the money. This story is so powerful because right at the beginning, Jesus demonstrates what God is like. And he gives the money. I mean, I don't know what scares you in life, but what should terrify you more than anything else is that God trusts you with your life. He lets you do what you want. He lets you do whatever you want with your money, your time, your body. And this is God, gracious in every way, just gives you what you, if that's what you want, if that's what you want to do with your body, if that's what you want to do with your relationships, if that's what you want to do with your money, I won't compel you. You can do what you want. And Jesus demonstrates that's what God's like. And he says, sure, have the money. Now, of course, it doesn't take long to guess what's about to happen. He runs off, it says, to a distant land. The NIV, I love the way the NIV renders it. It says, and he squandered his wealth in wild living. I love that. Wild living. I don't know how you'd interpret it. I mean, I imagine like a hip-hop video. So he's living. You've seen those? You're not supposed to see. Anyway. Squanders his wealth in a Snoop video. And says, kind of gives color to it. Anyway, so after he'd spent everything, it says there was a famine in the land. This is the thing he did not plan on. See, he thought he was in control of everything. And listen, if there's any who are running from God here, let me give you a cautious warning. And think of even your friends. Here's the truth. You think you're in control, but you're not. It's not the decisions you make that lead you into a goofy spot. It's the fact that you aren't in control of what can happen to you. He could not plan for the famine. People don't plan to get sick. People don't plan to lose their job. People don't plan to have a relationship go awry. It just happens. And so the famine hits. And so it says he hires himself out to someone of this foreign land, and he's tending pigs. Good Jewish boy tending pigs. This is bad. And you would think that this might be the moment he goes, what have I done? I should just go home. Oh, no. The moment, and if you underline your Bible, you should underline the phrase, when he came to his senses. The moment he comes to his senses is he looks at the pig food and goes, pig food. I should eat the pig food. And then he's like, what am I? Oh, my goodness. How far have I fallen? I want to eat pig food? Why is it that moment that he comes to his senses? Why wasn't it during the famine? Why wasn't it during the hip-hop video? Why wasn't it when he had pigs? He's like walking around with pigs. Why? I don't know why. And here's the truth. In all the years I've done ministry, all the years I've been following Jesus, this part is a mystery to me. I don't know what it takes for people to come to their senses. It's a miracle. I see this in my own life. There's things that I realize, like, wait a minute, I'm doing something really horrible here. And I think to myself, why? How could I have ignored this for a year or years of my life? And I don't know how that, I really don't know how that happens. It's like a miracle that God gives you awareness. You shouldn't be in this. You shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't live this. What are you doing? Here's the one thing I do know from years of ministry. When you come to your senses, you better respond and respond quickly because you will fall back asleep. You'll go right back to whatever you were doing. And I think all of us in this room could probably admit we've also experienced that. There's a moment, I know I got to change something, and you don't, and then you just kind of go back to whatever you're doing. And it might take weeks or months or years to come to your senses again. So in this moment, he comes to his senses, and he says to himself, what am I doing? My dad is rich. I should just go home. And so he begins to prepare a speech. Have you ever prepared a speech when you're in trouble? Liar. Of course you have. You didn't have like homework done or you did something that offended your parents or whatever. And you prepare a speech. You start mapping out a speech. He maps out a speech. And this is his speech. It's a great speech. He says, I know what I'm going to say. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. It's a great speech, isn't it? So just imagine walking home and he's doing the speech. Father, I've sinned. Right, so he's like, he's getting the cadence down. You know, he's working on the speech. So he's walking, working on his speech. And he looks up, and there's his father running towards him. I've never seen him run before. He's running really fast. I want you to imagine what you'd be doing as a son. He's 50 feet away. 10 meters away. Got to translate meters. He's 10 meters away. He's 5 meters away. What would you be thinking as your father's running at you? Now he's right on top of you. What do you do? Yeah, that's right. You duck your head. Because you're expecting him to punch you or slap you in the face. So he ducks his head because, you know, little tip, if you make somebody punch you in the top of your head, they'll break their hand. So you put your head like this. And you duck, and the next thing you know, he's wrapped you in his arms. What do you do next? You think this would be the moment you go, oh, all is well. I'm safe. This is beyond my wildest dreams. Because that's what happens, right? You've read the story. No, that's not what happens. Here's what happens. He starts his stupid speech. The difference between the practice speech and the speech he gives is poignant. He says, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. No longer worthy to be called your son. But what happens? The father interrupts the speech. He shouts out, quick, bring the robe. Bring a ring, put it on his finger, put sandals on his feet. Kill the fattened calf, for this son of mine was dead, and now he's alive. None of your speeches. I don't need your speech. You're home. You don't have to get this right. Your home. It's amazing how many of us are just keeping up our stupid speeches. Oh, I promise God, you know, if you help me get through this test, I'll stop smoking. You know what? I mean, it's just like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Your father's embracing you and you're doing a speech? What are you doing? Imagine this. This is the analogy. Imagine you're playing cards with God. I know, just stay with me. And you're playing cards with God, and I don't know if you've ever played cards with somebody that doesn't play cards the right way, and they just keep kind of like, I can see your cards. You got to keep, oh, yeah, yeah. He's like, all right, sure. Yep, sorry, my bad. I can see your cards again. You're, oh, yeah, my, sorry about that. See, it's happening again. So here's the thing. When you show your cards, it kind of ruins the game. It's not as fun. You know what? I don't want to play a game. I want to show you what's in my hand. All I have is grace. All I have is love. That's all I have. That's every card. That's all I've got. Because if you wondered for a second if you might get a slap instead of a hug, you would not come. So let me make this really simple. All I have is grace. All I have is acceptance. All I have is love. Just come. Stop playing the game. Now, most of the time, this is where we end the story, but this is not where the story ends. Because again, the audience is who? That's right, the Pharisees, the religious leaders. And the story ends with the older son in the field. The father has to leave the party to get the older son. And he says, why aren't you coming to the party? The older son says, well, I'll tell you why I'm not in the party. I've been here working the whole time. That's why I'm working now. He's like, working in the field. I'm just going to work during the party because I'm the older son. I just work. Have fun, you know, blah, blah, blah. And even the servants are like, hey, you should come in. He's like, no, I'm just going to work because that's what I do. I do the right thing. Enjoy your party. Dishonors the dad. The dad has to come out and go, come on in. He goes, dad, listen. I've been here working the whole time. This son of yours, he doesn't say his brother, this son of yours goes off and he wastes our money on prostitutes. And all he has to do is come home? No. No, this isn't fair. It's not fair. I've been here working. You didn't even give me a goat. I've never had a party like this. I've never had a party like this. This isn't fair. It's not right. And the dad just says, well, son, this brother of yours, not son of mine, brother of yours, he was dead. And now he's alive. We must celebrate. And the story ends with the older brother not entering the party. In this, Jesus is saying to the Pharisees, there is one party. You will either join it or you won't. But this is what God is doing. I want you to imagine we're all camping. This will all finish. But imagine we're camping. And I come to you and say, listen, guys, we're all around the campfire. Listen, my daughter, Sophia, she's 10 years old. She's lost. She was going down this path over here. She's wearing a pink jacket. I have a picture. I'm going to circulate it. I think if we hurry, it's about to get dark. If we hurry, we can find her. If we could break up and we run down these paths, we can find her. We should hurry. Okay? So you three, come with me. And we run down a path. And the rest of you are like, wow, this is intense. Like, Jay lost his kid. Like, okay, what do we do? He went that way. Maybe we should go. People start. And somebody says, well, hold on a minute. This is crazy. What are we doing? We're just going to start running around the woods. This is insane. We need a plan. Here's the thing. One of you says, I've taken a class on how to pursue lost people. So what we need here is just a quick second to, like, teach this class. So we can kind of get our act together, get organized. People are like, oh, yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good. And he starts his class. Someone says, well, you know, actually, I think what would help get us into the mood would be I have a couple songs about what it feels like to be lost and, you know, deep in the darkness, lonely sadness. You know, oh, yeah, let's say, what are the words? Put them, do we have, yeah, let me get some song sheets together. And then somebody else says, you know, here's the thing. I think if we just start running around there, we're going to be really lonely and like confused. And I feel like we're not connected enough to take on this work, you know. So I'm thinking, let's just make a little food, connect a little bit. And between the classes and the songs and our connection, I think we're going to be ready. Now, if I find my daughter and I make my way back to that fire and I see people teaching classes, singing songs, and having meals, you're going to be lucky if I just keep walking. You have to join the search party. That's what Jesus is saying. You want to be up to what the Holy Spirit's doing? Let me just make it really clear. He's pursuing those that are furthest away. Join him. Ask for him to put his really big heart in your little body. And I guarantee you, you'll live a life of adventure that you really can't imagine if you work with the Father pursuing those who are furthest. You get your eyes off your own stuff and you join with him in the great search, the great pursuit of people that are furthest away.